Thank you, Dr. Patterson, for that beautiful music. Good morning, brethren. It's certainly good to see you all today. It's a beautiful, beautiful Sabbath morning. I've been coming up once a year, which it seems is what I usually do. It's always nice to get reacquainted. Some I haven't seen in more than a year, so it's good to see other folks that are here visiting, and just really good to be here. Mr. Yule and I talked about it. I wanted to just announce one thing. It's not a big deal, except I probably won't be coming back every year during deer season. Next spring, Brenda and I will be transferred to Virginia, where we're going to be a pastor for a couple churches out there, and I'm also the part-time human resource person for United at this point, so I'll be spending some time in Cincinnati. So before you read it in the United News, I want to let you guys know in person, as you are my friends, and we'll see where it goes from here. But it's certainly good to be here, as always. And I was deciding which sermon I wanted to give today, and talked to Mrs. Yule, and she says, "Oh, let's hear that one. So if it's bad, it's Mrs. Yule's fault." But years ago, I used to subscribe to several newsletters, and I remember at one point reading one, and again, it's been probably 15 or plus years ago, but in one of the newsletters, it had an article, and it was simply titled, Noah's 10 Lessons. And you might have saw that same list at some point. And as I read through it, I was kind of amused by the article. But as I spent some time and went back through it and started pondering those points, I thought, while they're kind of lighthearted points, there's really some depth to them as we consider those and how they apply to us today. And so most of us here of all ages know the story of Noah's Ark, but we're going to kind of review that just quickly today. And then I want to take you through the top 10 lessons from Noah. I wasn't raised in any church, so my first exposure to the story of Noah was in a doctor's office. And I don't know if you remember back in the day, this is a long time ago, but they had the children's illustrated Bibles in there. So I remember, I could tell you exactly what Adam and Eve looked like because I saw pictures, But I can see that, what they looked like, and I can see, the story, as a youngster, they get you into it because they showed the serpent wrapped around the apple. I can envision that. But it was also the same with Noah's Ark. I can picture that picture, the colored picture in there, the ark sitting on a little mound, with all the animals just as far as you could see into the horizon, marching their way towards Noah's Ark in orderly fashion, right? Two by two. And as a child who didn't have any religious background, that really meant a lot to me. And really meant a lot when my mom found that child's illustrated Bible in my bag that I'd taken from the doctor's office. I don't remember the part of thou shalt not steal in that book, but I've learned that lesson pretty quick, even though my mom and dad did not attend church, and I didn't get to keep that book. But let's turn back. I just want to review that story of Noah's Ark just briefly this morning before we get into the message. So let's turn back to Genesis 6, where we'll start talking about this story. And again, we're going to just review it from a high level for the most part. So as we look at Genesis 6, we really just take verses 1 through 5 just and consider it. God's talking about seeing the wickedness in man. But specifically, as we look at verse 6, notice what he says in verse 6. He states something that I just can't truly imagine what he was feeling when he stated it. Verse 6, it says, "And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart." Can you even try to imagine what God was feeling at that point? If you're a parent, you think, of these people. What was he feeling when he said he was sorry that he had made man? I can't imagine what a terrible feeling that would have been for him. Verse 7. All right, it says he vowed to destroy man from the face of the earth. And in verse 8, just a few of you things here, notice what it says. It says, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Going on, it says, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. Verse 10, and Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. Does that sound at all like today? Picking up in verse 12, so God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And then he gives specific instructions here to Noah. It says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. Well, verse 15, and this is how you shall make it. So he gives him very specific directions. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits. Its width 50 cubits. Its height 30 cubits. And you shall make a window for the ark. And you shall finish it to a cubit from above. And set the door of the ark on its side, in its side, and you shall make it with a lower, second, and third decks. So again, he told him exactly what to do. Right? Do as I say. Verse 17, and behold, he says, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh having... All flesh which is the breath of life, everything that is on the earth shall die. But, he says to Noah, I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark. You, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And again, giving him very specific directions. Verse 19, and of every living thing of flesh you shall bring two of every sort into the ark, to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female. Verse 20, of the birds of their kind, of the animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind. And again, I can picture this, that little children's illustrated Bible, marching their way up to the ark. Verse 21, and you shall take for yourself all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be for you and them. And verse 22, thus Noah did, according to all commanded him, so he did. All right, we're jump down here. Let's go back, verse 22. It says, again, what it says, thus Noah did. God picked Noah because he was a just man. Okay? And now God has laid out this, I don't know if enormous task is the right description, but he's laid down enormous task before him. Instead of Noah saying, I think you got the wrong guy. Right? Or, what are you saying? What are you talking about? How am I supposed to build a boat? I'm in the middle of the desert. I mean, there's none of that. He didn't ask any of that. No, God, that's too much. Instead, he did it, as it says. He did according to what God commanded him. Drop down to chapter 7. Again, just as an overview, we see in verse 2, Noah's told to bring in seven pairs of the clean and one pair of the unclean animals. Verse 3, seven pair of each bird. Verse 4 and 5, then he starts saying, look, it's going to rain for a long time. It's going to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. And he reminds him, everything that's not on that ark with you is going to die. Verse 6, Noah was 600 years old when the flood happened. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But if we again review, if we look at verses 7 through, say, 10, we see again, Noah does what God has commanded him to do. Right? He takes his family into the ark. He follows God's directions. Verses 11 and 12, we see it starts raining just as God said it would. The flood starts, and it rains 40 days and 40 nights. Verse 20, then And you start to imagine this and try to fathom it. He talks about the depth of the water here. Right? He says, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. Think about that. Now, were the mountains the same height as they are now? I'm not going to say, well, they were, we don't know. But the mountains were covered. It's hard to fathom that. Verses 21 and 23 tells us again that everything not on that ark dies. Verse 24, and the waters then on the earth prevailed on the earth 150 days. If we drop over to chapter 8 then, verses 2 and 3, it talks about that time. Then when the waters start to begin to recede a bit, right? We know this story. We know the process. You know, verse 5, we finally see the tops of the mountains. Verses 7 through 12, we start to see that process of starting to send out the birds, right? Starting with the raven and then the series of doves to try to see some evidence of dry land. We know this story. Verse 13 and 14, finally the earth dried and the ark was opened. And we know then the rest of the story, at least up till now. But from those survivors, man and animal, were told that they were to scatter and that they were to be fruitful and they were to multiply. And we can see that that's what happened. Now, while we could then go back through this story and pick out individual verses, I will come back to some of them. There's so many different lessons that we could learn just from this one story of Noah. But today I want to go over it in just a slightly different way. And again, some of the points, these 10 points on the surface may seem a little lighthearted, but bear with me because they have some pretty critical meaning. So let's start out with the lessons from Noah, 10 lessons. Lesson 1 from Noah, and it's simply this: plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Let's go back to Proverbs. The book of Proverbs, chapter 6. I think is a great place to start as we begin to build our case for this first lesson. But Proverbs 6, I'll get there in a minute. Again, we'll start in verse 6, because as we consider this, we know that just in general, that planning ahead for anything, you know, is sound advice for all of us, that we shouldn't just wait until the last minute. But in Proverbs 6, verse 6, it reminds us that we should look to the ant for inspiration of how we should prepare for the future. Proverbs 6, starting in verse 6, it says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep?" Verse 10, "A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. And so shall your poverty come upon you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man." Brethren, a lesson we need to remember is that we have to be prepared spiritually and physically for the trials that are sure to come. We know that they're, as sure as rain, they're going to come. We can't wait until we're in the midst of it and say, "Oh, I should have planned for that better. Well, now what do I do?" You know, every day that passes, we are getting closer to that time when Christ is going to return. And the times are perilous, and they're going to get much worse. We know that. It's hard to see. It's hard to watch. It's sad to watch the news. And it just makes you, on one hand, just kind of sick to your stomach to see what's happening to our country, even and in our country. And I find myself challenged sometimes to take a step back and go, yes, but this has to. This has to happen. You know, it's hard. I think you know kind of what I'm saying. We can't speculate how soon that's going to be. No man knows, only God does. But the point is, now today, brethren, is the time to prepare ourselves for those end times, to live every day a life that is more pleasing to God, to stop wasting time. I look at all the time I've wasted in my life when I could have been just growing closer to God and staying close to the stalk. And as I'm getting older now, I'm thinking, what was I thinking? Why did I waste all that time? And I'll challenge everyone here, what are we thinking? We have to prepare. We have to be better at living a life that's pleasing to God, to go closer to Him right now, because as this poor's point was, it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. He planned for it, and we need to do the same. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 17, if you would please. Luke 17, as we'll see here, reminds me of today. You know, if we understand what it was like in the days of Noah, if we try to, and that God had said, you know, that He had just had it. Okay? I'm done with these people. I'm destroying them. If we try to consider that, verse 26 of Luke 17, we'll read verses 26 and 27. It says, "And as it was in the days of Noah," so bad, right, to say the least, "so will it be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives. They were given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all." How bad was it during Noah's time? What was it like? Back in Genesis 6, we kind of skipped over it. But I want to look at this, verse 12 and 13. Genesis 6, verse 12 and 13. We'll look at this just a little bit deeper. Right? Actually, we'll start in verse 11, where it tells us that the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. Does that sound familiar at all? This was Noah's time. Verse 12. "God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way on earth." In verse 13, "And Noah said to God, the end of all flesh has come before me. For the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." And so again, as I think about this, I try to fathom this a little bit more. I think, how much more disgusted was God? I'll use that word. How much more disgusted was God with the way it was then than it possibly is now? We don't know, right? We can't answer that, obviously. But most of the time when I read the scriptures comparing society's condition prior to the flood to what it's like today, I'm at a loss. Right? We just don't know. But we have to consider what it was like during Noah's time as we understand the story. And God knew, He talked about, He promised that He's going to protect Noah despite destroying the world. Again, that's what He's doing for us. He promises us, if you do what I say, it's not building an ark, it's a physical ark. He says, if you do what I say, you will not perish. That's a cue. When they're done listening, they turn the mic off. You're done. I've had that happen to me a lot. So, Genesis 6:14. Let's look at that again. Again, very specific. He said, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood and make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch." Right? And He told him, it's going to be this long, it's going to be this tall, it's going to be this wide. Right? You're going to put a window in this specific spot. You're going to put pitch here and there. And Noah did exactly, as we understand it, exactly what God told him to do. Because God promised, I'm going to save you. You do this. Again, verse 22, it says, "Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did." And so I guess a question I would ask each of us as we start to wrap up this first point of Noah is, are you could say are we, but let's make it specific. Are you building your own spiritual ark for the day for the storms that are coming? Are you building your spiritual ark? Because think about it, brethren. God told us basically the same thing he told Noah. There's a storm coming, and it's going to be bad. We know that's what's coming in our future. There's a storm coming, God tells us. It's going to be bad, and he's told us exactly what we're supposed to do. Build your ark in this way. Here are the specifics. He's given us instructions on what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to live, how we're to treat each other, how we are to obey him. My question is are we doing as Noah did in verse 22? Everything that God commanded him. Ask yourself, be honest. Are we doing that today? Or are we saying, well, that gopher wood, that's pretty hard stuff. I heard it's hard to work with, so, you know, a good quality pine, I think that'd be fine. You know, and putting pitch on the inside and outside, if I just put an extra thick coat on the outside, I bet we'll be good to go. I mean, you see, it is kind of funny, but isn't that how we think as humans? Well, yes, this applies to me, but, you know, God knows who I am, so he understands. And that's not going to fly, is it? Right? I'll just cover it with pitch. That should keep all the water out. So my question for you, if God's spiritual instructions to you and I were just like the plans God gave to Noah, would our spiritual ark float when we are done with it? Would we follow God's plans? A much better way to phrase that is, are we following God's specific plans today for building our own ark? Are we taking shortcuts? Point number one, again, was plan ahead, because it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Point number two is this: stay fit. Because when you're 600 years old, someone might ask you to do something really big. Obviously, my point is you're never too old or too young to be of service to God. You know, God, we know that we are to make efforts to remain physically and spiritually healthy so that we can be ready to serve when God calls upon us. We know that's part of our responsibility. And even when we start thinking about and take into account the ages to which people lived before the flood, I want to think about that for just a minute, because we have to understand that Noah was well into middle age. I want you to think about this, something I never realized until recently. Go back to Genesis 6 again. Something that my brain never really processed or thought about. Genesis 6, verse 3. Genesis 6, verse 3. And it says this, simply. Think about this. And the Lord said, he's talking to Moses, my spirit will not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. Think about it this way. Basically, God's saying that from that day on, okay, God's allowing people 120 years to get their act together. Wasn't talking about how long they're going to live necessarily. He's saying from this day forth, it's going to start raining in 120 years. So when we understand Moses then, right? It says in verse 7, chapter 7, verse 6, Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters came upon the earth. So we do a little simple math, back out of that, minus 120 years. Noah was 480 years old when he started building that ark. And again, if we jump back again, just to put things in context, right? My point is you're never too old to serve God. Genesis 5, verse 32. How old was Noah when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth? Genesis 5, verse 32. And Noah was 500 years old when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. 500 years old. And again, understand the period. People at that time had their children in their mid to late 100s. All right? But he was 500. All right? He was 500 years old. And again, think about Genesis 6, 18. Genesis 6, verse 18. Think about what's going through Noah's head here. He says, "And I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives." And then Moses, or Noah's head, he's probably going, "I'm getting kind of up there, God. We have no plans for any children." And I'm thinking Noah must have thought he was never going to have children, but God had other plans. Genesis 6:18, "I will establish my covenant with you. You shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your sons' wives with you." And again, this was when he was a mere 480 years old. But he had something, brethren, to look forward to. He had something to look forward to at this point. Point number three in the top 10 lessons from Noah is simply this: don't listen to the critics. Do what has to be done. God has given every one of us in this room a very special calling. And we have to make sure that no matter what, you know, we've heard the story, don't let anyone steal your crown. But we could also put it this way: we can't allow anyone else to divert us from our individual calling. As I think about the story of Noah and that 120 years that he had to build that ark, you know, and understanding how bad it was, just think about how much ridicule he endured during that 120 years. Hey, you crazy old man building that big boat. You know, I'm sure it was terrible. Right? Do something productive, right? I'm sure people were making fun of him all the time. But from what we can see here, he did not swerve from his calling. Right? He did everything as God commanded him. You know, we think about us in our life and our calling, whether it's family, whether it's friends, whether it's whoever, we all of us have at times been ridiculed for what we believe. And people have tried to convince us how crazy we are and that we're doing something that God never said. We've been ridiculed. You know, even today with staff, I have people every year that says, "Can we put up a Christmas tree in the business?" I'm like, "Oh, I don't own the business. Just, I don't want to do what you got to do." You know? And then they always the years, "Now tell me again why you don't keep Christmas." And you explain to them and they say, "Okay." You know? And then every year, you know, "Merry Christmas. Have a good day. You know, they don't understand. They don't accept it. And there's a little bit of a ridicule there. But just think about during this time, Noah did not listen to those critics. He did what had to be done. He did not swerve from what he had to do. There was a famous Minnesota governor, Jesse the Body Ventura, who you all are proud to have had as your governor. Remember him? Remember what he said about us, about people like us? He said, "Organized religion is a sham and a crutch for the weak-minded people who need strength in numbers." He said that on national TV. And there's another guy still on television. I don't think too much of him either, Bill Maher. But at the time, he played that clip over and over again because he agreed with Ventura at the time. Organized religion's a sham. It's just a crutch, something to lean on. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians. Because none of us in this room believe that, of course. And that's not what God tells us, as he tells us to not listen to the critics. Right? He says, don't listen to them. This is what you're to do. This is the way you're going to live. And this is, and I'm telling you to do what you have. I'm sorry, have to do. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. God, right? I was just thinking, God, do we have to remember? God has called us, right? And he understands what we have to do. But 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22. Let's see what it says here. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 22. It says, for Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. Verse 23, but we preach, this is important, but we preach Christ crucified to the Jews, a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Verse 25, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And finally, verse 26 says, for you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. Well, let's keep going here. Verse 27, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. He's chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. Again, he's talking about us, brethren. Verse 28, and the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen. He's chosen every one of us, handpicked. It's not an accident that we're here. It's not because of we're smarter than everyone else that we figured this out. God chose you. Handpicked by the creator of the universe. Going on here, verse 28. God has chosen and the things which are not to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. But, verse 30, but of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that as it is written, he who glories, let him glory in the Lord. That sounds familiar. In Walmart, maybe even. Christ has called, brethren, again, he's called, he's handpicked every one of us in this room for whatever reason that only he knows. But it talks about, and we need to remember, it kind of reminds us our place, it talks about how he picks the weak, right? And the base things. He says, I want you. And all you have to do is follow what I said in this book. Follow the directions, right? I've never been really good at that. You know, we get a shelf to assemble. My wife says, you should read the directions. I don't need no directions, right? Don't we do the same thing if we're honest with ourselves, with the Bible? Here are the directions. How to build your ark, how to build your cabinet. Just follow them. He tells us. And we have to. And again, as point three says, don't listen to the distractions. Don't listen to the critics. We know what we have to do. We just need to do it. Right? God has revealed his truth to us, and there is one truth. We know what it is. It's not hidden. God's told us. And he says, this is what you need to do. Do it this way. Point four, the lessons from Noah, is simply this. Build on high ground. Build on high ground, because all of us have been through storms in life, and we are going to be through more storms and floods. I remember I grew up in western Illinois, west central Illinois, about 40 miles east of the Mississippi River. And every year, during the spring thaw, there would be terrible floods. And I had family members that lived. They had their houses on stilts and everything. And almost every year it seemed, flood had come through, they'd lose about everything. And I remember just seeing people who were enduring the flood the second, the third, the fourth, I don't know, 15th time, and going, well, it was really bad this year. And in my little simple brain, when I was down there, I'm thinking, why don't you move? I think about the same thing for those living in Buffalo in the winter when they say, oh, we have 8 feet of snow last night. And I'm thinking, why don't you move? You know, that's a simple question. But I kept asking, why do you keep doing this? You know it's going to happen every year, time and time again. I don't understand. But then I think I started to apply that to my spiritual life and our spiritual life. And every time that sin comes back, I'm like, why do you keep going back? Why do you keep doing it again and again? And God tells us, right? He tells us as we start considering that flood that's going to happen and that keeps happening, he says, build on high ground. Don't build where the flood's going to get you. They're going to keep coming back. Stay out of those floodplains. Right? Make sure your foundation, your spiritual foundation, is built on high ground. Let's turn over to Matthew 7. Because Christ told us that if we do build our spiritual foundation on high ground, that we should be able to withstand any storm if we follow him and if we do the things that he says. Matthew 7, verse 24, talks about this, about building on a rock, right? Building on high ground. Matthew 7, verse 24, it says, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, again, that's the secret, right? That's the key part. Whoever does these things, who hears them and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. And it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. Verse 26, but everyone who hears these sayings of mine, right, think about this, apply it to yourself. Everyone who hears what I'm saying, who understands what I'm saying, and does not do them, will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, you know, like that guy down in Illinois that keeps building, you know, in the floodplain, looking for trouble. Verse 27, and the rain descended, and the floods came, and the wind blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. This is nothing new. We've been told all of our adult lives, you know, that we've been in God's church, that this is how we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to build our spiritual foundation. But let's be real again. Have we done that? Let's be real. Are we doing that? Are we not talking about it? How are we doing it once and for all? Are we building our foundation on high ground, on a rock, so that no matter what happens, okay, no matter what happens, we will be able to look at all the turmoil going on. And who knows what's going to happen even in God's church. I'm going to suggest that we're going to see things that we've seen before or worse. There'll be turmoil at some point in God's church as we get closer. I just think that's possible. But we won't and can't let that affect us. Right? We're told repeatedly we need to worry about and work on our own salvation. Do we believe that? Do we truly understand that? Is that who we are today? So if we haven't established our spiritual foundation on that high ground yet, if it's still a work in progress, let's get it shored up. Let's get it finished. And let's be ready for that storm that will come. Point number five in the top 10 lessons from Noah, this one always kind of cracked me up, is speed is not always an advantage. The cheetahs were on board, but so were the turtles. Think about it this way, brethren. We all run the same race, okay? We know what our goal is. We know what that finish line is. And there are some that might run it quicker than others, but we have to understand the most important thing is that we finish the race, that we finished what we started. I've heard many sermons over the years, you have too, talk about that this is a marathon. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon. It's an endurance race. Let's look at Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12, again, we'll see here in Hebrews 12, there's nothing new here. There's some good reminders, though. These are things that we know. And as we consider this point that speed isn't always an advantage, let's consider that as we read this. Hebrews 12, starting in verse 1, it says, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Again, brethren, it tells us this is a long endurance race. We can't start with just lots of zeal and run until we're exhausted and go, "I can't do this anymore. I'm too tired." Because I've known people like that. "I've been doing this so long. I'm tired. I can't do it." And then they leave. Brethren, we can't do that. We can't lose our energy. We can't lose our focus. Our race, brethren, let's consider this, it requires a steady, okay? It doesn't have to be necessarily breakneck speed, but it requires a steady, forward, constant movement. Becoming more Christ-like every day. Because if we're just saying, "I'm tired, I got to rest," whatever, if we're standing still, brethren, if we're, you know, telling God, "I'm sorry, God, I'm just going to rest for a while," you understand. If we're standing still, we're losing ground. We're losing ground, and we have to understand that. We have to keep moving ahead. As I look around this room, you know, and I've known many of you for several years, we'll talk about a point here in a little bit. Well, actually, it's the next point. But we have each other, and we talk to each other. When somebody's struggling and we're starting to coast, we need rest. That's where we grab each other. We build each other up. We throw the other one over our shoulder if we need to and say, "You're coming with me. I'll carry you for now. You carry me later." Point number five, speed isn't always an advantage. But point number six is what I'm speaking of now. For safety's sake, this is lesson six from Noah, for safety's sake, travel in pairs. Two heads are better than one. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. The wisest man, as we're told, ever to live, had something to say about the importance of friendship and how one can strengthen each other in a time of need. And he talks about, as we turn over to Ecclesiastes 4, verse 8, we're going to see he talks about the need for us all to strive to build good, solid friendships, right? So that we can help each other. Ecclesiastes 4, let's start in verse 8. It says, "There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, 'For whom do I toil and deprive myself of good?' This also is vanity and grave misfortune." Verse 9, "Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him," he says, "who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. And verse 11, and if two lie together, down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Verse 12, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Brethren, we need each other. We need each other, even not just once a week on the Sabbath. We need each other. We need to take advantage of the time that we spend together. And again, we're spread out. I get that. And we're very spread out. But we need to make efforts to spend time together, not just on the Sabbath. We need to stay in contact with each other. We need to know, and we need to be honest with each other when we're struggling, so that we can pick each other up. We can carry each other. We can support each other. We can exhort each other. See, we can't underestimate the value of the connection that you have here in Eau Claire, that God has provided, and we have to take advantage of that. Because you think about this, we are all that we have in this world is each other, and we need each other. So point number seven, or six, travel in pairs. Two heads are better than one. Point number seven is this. Simply, don't forget that we're all in the same boat. And I hope that that's something that we remember really at all levels of our relationships, whether it's marriage, whether it's family, whether it's the Eau Claire congregation, whether it's the United Church of God as a whole. We can accomplish more of God's work. We can accomplish so much more if we're all rowing in the same direction, rowing at the same pace, so we're not going just in circles. If we're working as a team, because Satan is working hard on God's church. Satan knows God's plan. He hates us. And he will do anything he can to distract us as we go. He is working hard on God's church. And you look around, and even as you read things, you can see that whether it's here or anywhere, that there are people in God's church that are not always willing to be in the same boat. They have their own thoughts. They have their own way that they think things should happen. And we have to remember that that's not what God expects. And we have to be very careful, because it's very troubling, and we have to be very clear as individuals that we make sure that we are not fooled, that we're not sidetracked, that we're not distracted. Again, there is one truth, and I think you've all proven it to yourself. We cannot be distracted. We know what God expects of us as individuals. I think about this. If everyone in the United Church of God, okay, would adhere to this one principle, that we are all in the same boat, right, that we're all trying to get to the same place, if we all remembered that in God's church and adhered to that principle, just think about how much better it would be, how smooth things would flow, maybe how much more of God's work we would be able to do. Point number eight is my favorite lesson in the 10 lessons from Noah. And it simply is this. Remember that amateurs built the ark and professionals built the Titanic. I like that. And there are two things I want to point out from this statement. Number one is that we need to not be intimidated from not accomplishing what God has set before us. We can't be intimidated by the work that he's told us to do, because as it tells us, if God is for us, who can be against us? And point number two that I want us to remember is that we need to not put faith in what the world says is infallible. Remember what we read earlier in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 27, when it says God has chosen the foolish of the world to put to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. It replies in this point where amateurs built the ark and professionals built the Titanic. And I have a little information I'll share with you, and you probably know this. But consider this. The Titanic, let me read this. The Titanic was constructed in Belfast, Ireland by the building firm Harland & Wolff. And she was a technical marvel of the Edwardian period, built and finished within 3 years. Well, that amateur Noah took 120. Right? He didn't know what he was doing. The Titanic had double bottom and 16 compartments formed by 15 watertight bulkheads running across the ship's hull. And as you go through that, and as I was reading the story, it came up, it talked about, you know, an account I read of the safe features, a phrase that they talk about and repeated often by the founder and the president of the White Star Line, Bruce Ismay. This is as the Titanic is setting sail from Southampton. He says to the crowd as he points at the ship, he says, God himself couldn't sink that ship. And I don't know, you know, my little brain, I don't know, but I wonder if God was sitting up there thinking, oh yeah? Yeah, I'm demeaning God's way of thinking, of course, but yeah, you have to wonder a little bit anyway. I don't know. But again, understand, amateurs built the ark. Professionals built the Titanic. My point is, we cannot be intimidated by doing what God has told us to do. From accomplishing the work that he's put before us, even though he calls us the foolish and weak things. Point number nine. Point number nine in the lessons from Noah says, it is simply this. Remember that the woodpeckers on the inside of the ship are often a bigger threat than the storm on the outside. It's a fact, and we know that a little hole can sink a big ship if it's not repaired. And let me explain a little bit. And again, as we focus this on ourselves, and we need to, brethren, as I'm saying, look at ourselves every day and examine ourselves for any leaks to make sure that our spiritual ark, our spiritual ship, hasn't sprung a leak that's been undetected up to this point. Not just at Passover time every year, but daily. We need to be introspective. We need to strive, brethren, to illuminate, to find, to seek out, to fix any weakness that could cause a fatal error if not taken care of right now. Again, if we look back at what God instructed Noah, he told him in Genesis 14, he says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Right? He tells him specifics. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. I want to talk about that just a little bit, digress a little bit, because this is very interesting. Let's look at Genesis 6, verse 14, okay, if you're there, where he uses the word pitch for the first time. That's Strong's number, that first time he uses pitch, that's Strong's number 3732, and it refers to the word kaphar, K-A-P-H-A-R. And that literally means, as it says here, to cover. And in all places, it says to cover completely. It also means to make an atonement for, which is another way that this word is used. So to use it figuratively, it means to appease, to atone, to purge, to reconcile. Okay, so that's the first place pitch is used. The second time it's used, the word pitch is used in Genesis 6:14, it's Strong's number 3724, and it's kopher, K-O-P-H-E-R. And it means, at that point, it means as a ransom, as a satisfaction, as a price for your life. Now, I think about that, right, about what the literal and figurative meanings are here. And as I read this, I see just as the pitch made the wark watertight, okay, these two different uses of this word are a picture of Christ as our atonement. Right? This is talking about how the pitch is used outside, you know, the person and the vessel to seal them off, and how it's used inside, on the inside, as Christ is our redemption. Those in the ark were saved because the pitch protected them from the death outside. And we could talk a lot more about how those two words are used there. But think about it this way. Those people, like us, we should say, are protected. Those that are in Christ are protected, I should say. It's easiest to say that way. That was point number 9. My final point, as we start to wrap up here, that I want to share with you, maybe the most important lesson of all from the top 10 lessons of Noah. And it's simply this, is that no matter how bleak it looks, if God is with you, there's always a rainbow on the other side. And I wonder during the flood, as faithful as a man as it says God was, I have to wonder if he worried at all during the flood. Maybe not. But in my mind, you know, that 40 days and 40 nights of rain, and if he looked out the window to see what was going on, or if he could hear the people outside, you know, how that affected him, what was he thinking? It had to be nerve-wracking. And then another 150 days before the waters even started to recede. And again, I asked myself, knowing that fully well he was likely more converted than I am, is did he ever doubt? Was there ever a worry, you know, in his mind how this was going to play out? See, again, my point in this case is it had to be fierce. You know, we need to remember that no matter how fierce that storm is outside, no matter how long it rages, and this keeps going and going and going, and we wonder what's going to be the outcome of this, we have to remember that if we stay close to God, that God will deliver us. It's a fact. It may not be in this life. We know that. This life is temporary, but may not be in this life, but he will deliver us. And I'm sure Noah's hope, I should say, had to be tried during the flood. Because there's only so much you can anticipate. It's going to rain for 40 days and 40 nights. Everybody's going to die. You know, and you're like, okay. But to be in it and to listen and to watch and endure and to worry, we have to consider Noah, and we need to keep our hope in God that no matter how bleak it looks, no matter how long the storm continues, that God promises if we do what we're supposed to do and stay close to him, follow his directions, that he will deliver us. So, those are the 10 lessons I wanted to share with you today about Noah's Ark. And I hope that you'll look back on them a little bit and study them, because there are sub-points in there that we can gather, because I think they're important. They're worth remembering. But if I had to, just in a closing statement, wrap it up in a little nutshell, I would say this. Simply remember to prepare now for the storms ahead, because they're coming. And we need to remember that no matter how fierce that storm is, no matter how long it rages, no matter how long that it continues, that if we have built our house on high ground, if we have built our spiritual ark to God's specifications, that we will remain safe and that God will deliver us.